I'm going to call the meeting to order. This is the Health and Human Services Finance Division. We do have a quorum, so I think we're still waiting for our testifiers just for a moment. So members have plenty of time to review the minutes. We could have a big discussion about the minutes. Representative Hamilton.
I'll move the minutes.
Representative Hamilton moves the minutes of January 30th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Come on, let's have some discussion. Okay. Okay, over the minutes. Representative Grunhagen could give an argument on the minutes, I think. Okay.
Only if it has Minshew.
Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Okay, so we are ready to begin. And members, today we are talking about state health care purchasing. And this is a huge issue for us as a legislature because this is how our Medicaid or medical assistance, as we call it here, these services are delivered, health care services. We're going to talk about how those services are financed and delivered. And as if you recall, and I didn't look up the numbers before I came to committee, but it's over 1 million Minnesotans who are on our Medicaid program. I think it's something like 80,000 more who are on our Minnesota Care program. And so how we get the money to the providers who provide the service to these people who are on our health care programs is really important. And we know that we are not only responsible for making sure that a lot of our most vulnerable people get these really critical services, but also that we spend lots and lots of state and federal money. So I think it's really important that we understand how the system works and maybe how sometimes it doesn't work as well as we'd like it to. So welcome to the committee, and pleased to have you here to start explaining a little bit of this to us. And so we're going to start out with the Department of Human Services, and appreciate your being here. Please introduce yourselves and go ahead with your presentation. Oh, and members, let's adhere to the procedure we've been using pretty successfully, which is if you have a question that's substantive, just hold your question until kind of the end of a section. And if our testifiers could let us know when that is, that we could ask questions so we don't interrupt you too much. But if you do have a question like, what is that acronym, or I can't read, I don't know what slide we're on or something, please do ask that kind of question, and we'll get that information. So thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Julie Marquardt. I'm the Director of Purchasing and Service Delivery at DHS. And we apologize for the delay. PJ, our harrowing experience of being stuck in an elevator at DHS is our nightmare is over. So I'll let my colleagues also introduce themselves.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm PJ Weiner, the Manager for Alternate Purchasing Strategies here at DHS.
Hello, I'm Heather Peterman. I'm the Division Director for Healthcare Research and Quality Area at DHS.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, I think everyone has the presentation in their packets, and we're going to follow the presentation. I will let you know when we're switching between. As you indicated, we have about 20% of Minnesotans are on one of the public health care programs in our state. So that's 1 in 5 Minnesotans. The total for all programs is 1.2 million people. It is around $12 billion a year in health care costs that we are spending to provide services to these individuals. I am going to go through, just so you know, the purchasing that we do generally now. We use one of two methods. We use fee-for-service or we use managed care. But we also invited Heather Peterman to talk about an evolving strategy that we've been working on with the legislature for several years around our integrated health partnerships. So we're going to cover all three for you today. As I indicated, the two main ways that we currently purchase health care are through fee-for-service. which about 25% of that 1.2 million people receive their payment for their services in this way. In that, providers directly enroll with DHS. DHS directly pays the claims for any services that those enrollees go to seek from our enrolled providers. It's a pretty straightforward way, but there's some limitations to that on cost containment and some things. And there isn't a lot of care coordination or things built around that program. So it's maybe not, it has become an antiquated model, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have a base or a purpose that couldn't be leveraged for other things. The second way that we purchase is through managed care organizations, and about 75% of the 1.2 million people receive their care through this method. In this method, DHS pays a capitated monthly per member per month payment for each individual that's enrolled in managed care, and the managed care organization then pays the claims to providers for services that those individuals receive care from. So in the first method, fee-for-service, the legislature has actually set the rates that we pay to providers. So that is a role you all play to set the rates in fee-for-service. In managed care, the managed care organizations actually negotiate the rates that they pay to providers. And so we don't directly dictate what those rates are. Those are set through a contract between the providers and the managed care organizations. So moving on, again, in a managed care situation, we are making a prepaid monthly capitation fee. If the costs for any enrollee should exceed that, there's no additional payment made, so the managed care organizations bear the risk if the costs for those enrollees in any given month or throughout the course of the entire year should exceed the payments that were made. They are bearing the risk for that. And again, as I mentioned, the provider contracts may vary, and it's important to know that there are federal regulations around how much a state can dictate provider payment rates in a managed care arrangement. So we are going to talk a little bit about some of those changes that have occurred in federal regulation, but PJ will get a little more into that. So the next slide is just a history of managed care, and for those of you who don't know, it's been around in Minnesota for a long time. We have been using managed care as a purchasing strategy since the 1980s. Our implementation of managed care for public programs predates any of the federal regulations from CMS around managed care. So we do struggle a bit with not all of our state laws have been updated to necessarily reflect all of those federal changes. So sometimes it's difficult to navigate some of those conflicts or understand what the clear direction is. As you can see, we just wanted to mark some of the key points in time of when we had managed care, Minnesota Care came into being. Minnesota Care was originally a Medicaid waiver. It was a waiver of our Medicaid program, but as you can see in 2015, that became what is allowed under federal law as a basic health program, which changed the nature of how that program is financed, but also it requires us to purchase for those enrollees, and it is about 80,000 people, we have to purchase through a managed care arrangement for that particular program. The next.
And Ms. Marquardt, if I could just for members, you know, we have members on this committee who are new to the legislature, and also for anyone who's watching, I think that often the terms get really confusing. So because this slide has several of them, I just want to make sure people note that we use these different terms. Medicaid is being used on this slide, which is the big program, which is state and federal. And then we have Minnesota Care, which was the smaller program that was initially a creation of Minnesota and now has morphed into a program that is largely funded with federal funds but is very different. And that, although the term is not on this slide, MinSure is something completely different, which is just an exchange on which people buy insurance or enter into some of these. So Yeah, I know that it often remains as clear as mud for people, but I just want to at least say that so that people have a fighting chance if anybody's new to this field.
Yes, I appreciate that, Madam Chair. So the other term that you will see used in place of our Medicaid program, which is our state and federal funded program and the largest population, is in Minnesota law, it's termed medical assistance. So if you hear medical assistance, that's generally, and I won't say 100% of the time, is also interchangeable with Medicaid. So we use those two terms quite interchangeably, and it does create confusion, and I apologize for that. Then finally, within those populations, and not to make this any more confusing, but it will, who are the populations that are covered? The largest population is families and children. We have three contracts with eight managed care organizations, and families and children is a large contract that covers about 800,000 people, and they are pretty evenly distributed between Greater Minnesota and Metro. So these are people all over the state. This is actually a contract that covers both non-disabled adults and non-seniors in Medicaid, and it includes the Minnesota CARE population. So we're combining the two, and I apologize again that if you're new to this, that keeping this all straight, I appreciate it's difficult, and we're happy to help translate for anybody who gets confused at any time. So that is by far our largest contract and our largest population served in managed care. But then you can see we also have products that cover adults with disabilities. If you hear the term special needs basic care, that is our adults with disabilities program. And then we have a seniors program, and that covers people 65 and older who are income eligible for Medicaid. So the adults with disabilities products and the seniors products are Medicaid or medical assistance. That's how they receive their funding. There is no Minnesota CARE within those populations. So I'm going to stop there before we get into things around how we determine which managed care organizations. I do want to reference the maps that are in your packet. The maps are just simply showing of those eight managed care organizations that we contract with today, for which product are each county, who is serving those counties across all products. And you'll see there's a variety of different plans and different products in different counties. Some for certain products may have one plan choice. In other counties for certain products there may be five choices. So we just wanted to give you that for reference, not to go through it in any great detail.
Great, thank you. And this is, members, it's separate in your packet, separate from the slide deck and all these nice colorful maps. So we do have some questions. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a couple quick questions. So how does county-based purchasing mesh with this? Because they get their...
And Representative Grunhagen, we're going to actually have part of our presentation is going to be on that. But so if
okay.
You could just give a really brief answer.
Well, I can wait.
No, I think it's a great question because the context is really important. So if you could just give that context, and then we're going to hear more about that later in the presentation. So Ms. Marquardt?
Sure, Madam Chair. We have, of the eight managed care organizations, so we use that term globally to describe any entity that falls within a managed care arrangement. That includes three county-based purchasing plans. So those are plans that are operated by a county or group of counties. We have a licensed HMO that operates in Hennepin County, and then the remaining are for our licensed HMOs with the Department of Health.
Okay, just one follow-up.
Grunhagen.
In the other area, and I'm just bringing this up from memory, I think, is that in the past it was indicated that DHS had a hard time counting the people on Medicaid as far as the numbers are concerned. Has that been rectified, or what's the status of that?
Ms. Marquardt, we don't want to go too far off base here, but can you answer that briefly?
Madam Chair, I'm not – maybe we could – talk further. I'm not clear on okay. Any issues that we had with identifying the number of people on the program. It may maybe we can figure out what the specific question is.
Okay. I'll talk to you after this.
All right. Thank you, Representative Grinhagen. Representative Munson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question on the slide number six, where it categorizes the families and children, adults with disabilities, and seniors. In which of these three categories, or maybe it's not at all, are the Medicaid expansion to cover adults without children? Are those in the families section?
Ms. Marquardt?
Madam Chair, yes. The adults without children expansion population would be included in the families and children contract.
Okay, then an important follow-up question, Madam
Chair. Representative Munson.
I'm just trying to understand the for those programs that are covered through the managed care, are those do they have fixed fees for all the services? Like they're going to tell the providers what they will pay, and maybe they can put into change it based on where the provider is located, or is the state paying these managed care providers for a fixed amount for services, and then like Blue Cross, who might be the one or another insurance company who manages that billing, do they go and negotiate separately with the providers?
Really important question, Ms. Marquardt.
Okay. Madam Chair, how you described it is the second is correct. We pay a fixed rate, and it's basically an average rate per region that is risk adjusted, so based on the acuity of any given plan's population. From that, how the providers get paid is based on a negotiated contract between providers and the managed care organization.
Thank you. So
okay. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm also looking at slide six. And looking under the family and children, you know, often we talk about the dwindling population in the rural community, and the urban is the population is so much more individuals. But here we look at the number of folks who are covered through managed care, and the numbers between rural, greater Minnesota, and metro are so close to me. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Ms. Marquardt?
Yes, Madam Chair. We do see that it is quite evenly distributed because families and children is not on the basis of age or disability. It is truly about people's income levels. There are people throughout the state of all income levels, and so we're seeing that distribution really play out. That it doesn't matter, There are people of lower income that are living in the furthest rural areas of greater Minnesota, and they're eligible for this program, and we provide the same level of services and care to them that we provide to people in the metro area who are also low income. And the hope is that we're providing similarly situated people the same experience, the same level of care. And that can be challenging with geographic areas where there may not be as many providers. The density of those providers, the distances may change, but we really strive to provide a similar level of service for everybody, so everybody is well served.
Representative Moran?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Neuer? No? Okay. Representative Kunesh-Podein?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. On slide two, you were talking about the provider payment contracts and how they vary, and how they still have to cover the costs of medical care, no matter if they contract at this level, but the level is but the actual cost is higher, and can they drop somebody from acting as their provider? I don't know how to exactly say this, but can somebody be dropped because they are costing that provider more than they are receiving?
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, the answer is yes. I mean, a provider can stop participating in the medical assistance or Medicaid program if they chose, but that would mean they could provide services to no one. The exception to that is you can, so in state law, we have a requirement which people refer to as Rule 101, which means that if you are a provider and you wish to serve state employee groups, county groups, school districts, any workers' compensation where there is government funding going into those, that in order to serve those populations, you must also serve the public programs population. So you could do it. It's not impossible for a provider to do. The one exception that I believe 2 years ago, dental providers in Greater Minnesota do not have to meet that standard. And then if a provider can meet it, however, by only participating in managed care, so they could have a contract with one managed care organization and not contract with the others or not even participate in fee-for-service. Okay. So there are some ways that they can limit who they see, but they can't simply drop a patient. There are federal laws and rules around patient dumping, things like that, that would also come in that we don't regulate. So they would have to do it within a way that is non-discriminatory, is not considered patient dumping. There are other requirements for them in just dropping somebody.
Okay, and Representative Kunesh-Bean, you were talking about the provider of the health care, not the MCO, right? Not the managed care. Okay, I just wanted to make sure I had understood that. Are there other questions from members? Okay, I'm sure there will be more let me ask you one, Ms. Marquardt. I have a lot of questions, actually, but I'll just ask you this one. You mentioned that managed care organizations bear the risk. But I have always understood that under federal law that we're required to have a quote-unquote actuarially sound rates. So that, say, 1 year there were really high, or one contract term, I guess, there were really high costs and the MCOs lost money. Isn't it true that then the state has to kind of make them whole and make sure that next year that's not going to happen? Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, we do not make them whole. I would not say that. We do have to consider, so let's say there is a year where there is consistent downside experience by all the managed care organizations, we would have to look at that and determine, did we have our trends correct? Did we have, but if it is one plan who experiences a loss, but other plans are not experiencing a loss, it is hard for us to say that the rates were wrong. But our actuaries every year have to review and look at, are the trends right? Is there an adjustment? Was there something in the marketplace that was unexpected? Is it still going to be the same for this year? And so we have to take all those things into account. So in any given year, they're bearing the risk. How much of that plays into whether or not the rates go up or down next year? It can, but it will never be made to bring anybody to whole or to make up for previous year's losses. We do not do that.
Okay. And Ms. Marquardt, let me just follow up by asking you this. Going back, it would be really interesting to me to see over the trajectory of this whole program. You gave us this nice timeline that DHS began using MCOs in 1985. And I know it's considered a demonstration project, right? And still in law, it's a demonstration project. And the question really is kind of, what is it demonstrated? But that's not really my question. But the question is, would be really nice to see over that trajectory what, how the finances of the how the MCOs have done with the public programs. We're just talking about them bearing the risk. And it's my understanding that under this program that sometimes they've built up their reserves quite a bit while serving our public programs. In other words, I guess that would mean that either they've been really good at squeezing down costs or we've overpaid them, one or the other. But it would be really nice to see that trajectory over time. If you even have that data, do you even have that data?
Madam Chair, we do have, we can certainly provide you with some recent year data, probably within the last, five to 6 years. So we certainly have that data going back even prior to when we started the competitive price bidding. So you're right. I think there, in all fairness, there was a lot of concern by a lot of parties about the profit margins that plans had been making historically. And we did, working with legislators, implement some tools and different approaches to ensure that we were paying fair rates, but rates that were not building profits that were unacceptable to most people. So we do have that, and we can provide that.
Great, that would be great. And I think you're going to talk a little more about all of that procurement. Am I right? So it looks like coming up. So I will let you go ahead and do that. Thank you.
So as we talked about the managed care organizations that participate in the program, we thought we would talk a little bit about how we decide who participates and what that process looks like. The procurement process is used to determine which health plans participate in medical assistance or Medicaid and our Minnesota Care programs. DHS will issue a request for proposals, and the health plans will respond to that request. The RFPs are developed by DHS with assistance from the Department of Health and our counties here in Minnesota who develop the RFP and then also score the proposals to determine who will be offered a contract. And the evaluation of the RFP is on quality and service delivery. That's the bulk of the review. And there may also include a price component, or as Julie referred to, a competitive price bid in some years. And then the final decision as to who will receive the offer of a contract is made by the DHS commissioner. And every time we do this process, we're asked, why do we have to go through this again? So we are required by federal law to have competitive procurements, and we're also required under state law to re-procure our contracts every 5 years. But more importantly, the process ensures that we have the highest quality care at the best value for our enrollees, and that's important because managed care contracts cost more than $5 billion annually. Now, there have been some changes in the landscape since our last statewide procurement, and we wanted to highlight a couple of those as we head into another procurement year. So in 2016, there was a federal managed care regulation that was finalized, and that regulation strengthened some conflict of interest protections. It also reinforced the competitive bidding requirement. And there is a provision that prohibits states from requiring specific payment rates to providers except for under certain limited conditions. And then we also had some state law changes in 2017, including the law that allows for-profit health plans to do business in the state, and also a phasing out of certain payments to hospitals that are no longer allowed. And we wanted to include the schedule of what our upcoming procurements will look like. We will be issuing an RFP in 2019 for 2020 contracts in Greater Minnesota for the Families and Children and Minnesota Care contract. That Families and Children includes that Adults Without Children population that we mentioned before. In 2019, we will also be releasing an RFP for 2020 contracts, and that's statewide for our seniors products. And then in 2020, we will release an RFP for 2021 contracts in the metro area for the Families and Children population, including Next Generation Integrated Health Partnerships, which Heather will talk a little bit about, as well as our Minnesota Care contracts. And so I can stop there before we move on to integrated.
Great. Thank you. We do have a question. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As far as the 2019 procurement for the 2020 Greater Minnesota contracts, earlier you said that the department may include price components in their RFPs for procurement process. For the process later this year, will the department be including a price component in this competitive bid process for Greater Minnesota for 2020?
Ms. Marquardt?
Madam Chair, that decision has not been finalized, and that will be released when the RFP goes out.
Representative Zerwas.
Is there a timeline on that?
Ms. Marquardt?
Madam Chair, are you asking about when the decision will be made or when the RFP will be released?
Representative Zerwas.
Well, I think, Madam Chair, I guess both. And wondering, when will we be able to know? I guess is maybe the more direct question.
All right, Ms. Mark.
Madam Chair, that's It's a discussion that we're finalizing with our commissioner right now, and so I anticipate that is something he would determine he could share with you when that decision is made. And then the RFP is coming out in February is the anticipated date for that.
Representative Zerwas.
And then just one last question for right now, Madam Chair, for Ms. Marquardt. Earlier it says that the competitive bid procurement, or the competitive procurement, is required under federal law. I'm wondering if you can provide, and not that I expect you to know it off the top of your head, but if you could cite the specific federal statute and provide that to members of the committee. I know that's a question that I get quite frequently and just don't have that information at my fingertips.
Ms. Marquardt, can you do that?
Madam Chair, yes, we can provide that to you.
Good. Thank you. And thanks. I think that's a really good request. And there are some other things on your slides, too, that about what federal law is requiring. And I assume it's kind of all in the same spot or close. Maybe you could give us some of those references in addition.
Sure. Madam Chair, we can provide that for you as well.
Okay, very good. And would you pronounce your name for me again? Is it?
Sure, it's Weiner.
Weiner, okay. Okay. So, yeah. That can be pronounced a bunch of different ways, right? Okay. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my question was along the same lines as Representative Zerwas, so I'll pass.
Okay. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In looking at slide 9, in regards to the state law that changed in 2017, we talked about the phasing out of certain payments to hospital. That are no longer allowed. Can you talk a little bit about what those are?
Ms. Marquardt. Madam Chair, yes. These are, the federal regulation no longer allows us to what's called a pass-through payment. So we had, through managed care, so we had two supplemental payments, one that went to Hennepin County Medical Center and one that went to Regents Hospital. That were being passed through our managed care organizations, and we worked with those hospitals, I believe it was 3 years ago now, on a phase down for those to become compliant. We were allowed up to 10 years to phase those down. And so we worked with the hospitals on how to do that, and we are on an 8-year phase down.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just so I can better understand this, so what's the impact of that? I mean, what happens?
Ms. Marquardt?
Madam Chair, so in the net of everything, it is lost money certainly in the year that they would have otherwise received it. There would have been money that was being paid from the managed care organizations to those individual hospitals in that year. They are able to recover part of that. It comes at a little bit later time. So there's a bit of a timing issue because we also provide supplemental payments to both of those hospitals up to what's called their hospital-specific disproportionate share hospital limit, which is a whole big other regulation about you can't pay any hospital more than their costs, any group of hospitals in the same category, any higher than their cost for their cost to provide services to Medicaid enrollees and their uninsured costs. So they are able to recapture some of that lost revenue and quite a lot of it through that supplemental payment, but there was a timing issue in that they were receiving that money later.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
Because I know Region Hospital is probably taking in a disproportionate amount of numbers of uninsured and Medicaid patients. And so, just looking at whether or not they're able to continue to deliver services.
Ms. Marquardt?
Yeah. So, Madam Chair, I would also add just to not that I don't think either HCMC or Regions is going to come up here and say we're wildly overpaying them. But I will say we have worked with the Hospital Association, with those particular hospitals. We have payment mechanisms through our fee-for-service rates where we pay what's called DISH or disproportionate share hospital. There are some add-ons to those payments that are also made to compensate for those as well. And so we, like I said, I'm not standing here saying they're fully compensated for 100% of their costs because they're not. But we do work with the safety net hospitals in communities to make sure that we are not having them unfairly bear a burden if they're seeing high volumes of Medicaid enrollees.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question about the managed care organizations, the overall accounting that they use. When we talked about, it's my understanding under the Affordable Care Act, that for the first few years of launch, they would make these managed care organizations whole if their costs outweighed their revenues they were bringing in from premiums, and that's since gone away. But there really wasn't an incentive for them to lower costs during that time, since they could always be made whole. But is there, in the RFP process, when you put out your request for proposal from these managed care organizations, does the state ask what their either cap or ask that they report their percentage of profits that they bring in? And I guess since we're talking mostly about nonprofits, their expenses that, or the overhead, the expenses that exceed what their billables are?
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, so I think I just want to clarify that I think some of your initial comments probably applied to the exchange, which our plans are not on the exchange and not part of the exchange, or what I think Madam Chair referred to as MNCHRE, that's separate. So we have done this rate setting for many years, and so the Affordable Care Act changed some things related to how we do our rate setting, the actuarial soundness, some of those components, but we didn't have any specific things regarding we had to make them whole or backstop any losses, things like that. But what we, with respect to the second part of your question, which I want to make sure I'm answering, so can your second part was about financial reporting. Is that
Representative Munson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So if a Bob's Insurance Company wants to be the managed care provider for an area for these programs, and you're paying the Bob's Insurance Company $40 for an office visit, and they're giving the provider $30, is there something in the reporting that you're asking back from that provider that they're going to be capped at 25% of their billables of what they can keep? Or do they have to report it to you? Are their books open to the state to look at since this is being paid for by taxpayers? That's kind of my question.
Could I maybe, before Ms. Marquardt answers, I think Representative Munson, and I want to answer because I've been in your shoes, right? And that is just to understand that the state is paying a one flat amount to the managed care company for per person. And how they figure out what that amount should be is kind of a deep question. But so DHS is paying a flat amount, and then that managed care organization is completely on its own to figure out how much it's paying that provider, how much it pays the doctor, how much it pays the dentist, and all of that. Does that kind of help? And I think another confusion, which I totally understand, a lot of the same companies are selling individual policies on the exchange that you could go and buy as a consumer through MNCHRE, and they're also working with the state to provide public programs. But they're very different things. So I think what Ms. Marquardt was saying, that what you were talking about risk corridors, had to do with exchange policies, individual market policies that you could buy. What we're talking about is public programs that an individual consumer doesn't go and buy. The state contracts on behalf of the consumers that are eligible. Does that help a little bit?
Well, Madam Chair, so this is so a resident that's on MA that goes to an office, goes to a doctor, and the doctor is paid $40 or $30 for that office visit. The state is paying, this is what the capitation fee is per person. They pay a flat fee. They are not paying individual fee for service.
Exactly. Okay. At least for 75% of the people, as she started out explaining, that are I was going to ask you too. I use the term PMAP, P-M-A-P, right? And I understand that stands for prepaid medical assistance program, and I don't know if that's the common term now that we use to describe this capitated system. Is that the term you use?
Madam Chair, I don't personally use it as very often, but that's not that other people don't. We are trying to, I think, stay a little bit cleaner between Medicaid funding, Minnesota Care BHP funding, and then the populations and products. But the prepaid medical assistance program is kind of that, it at least gives you that description of we're prepaying for somebody's health care in the MA program. So I think it's a term of art that was kind of created at the time to help people understand these differences.
Yes, okay. So that's what we're talking about and here.
So follow up, yes. Madam Chair. The reason I'm bringing this up is because I think a lot of us are talking to the hospitals and trying to understand that they're being the low reimbursement rates for Minnesota Care. And is it because that's what we are paying at the state, or that's the decision that's being made by the managed care organization? And if it is, then where are the books to show how, you know, to justify how low that reimbursement rate is? And are those books, do we have a right to go back and say, let's see what your, profitability is, or how much money that you're keeping for overhead in that, in managing that program?
Well, Representative Munson, I am so glad you're asking these questions, because this is one of the key reasons we're having this hearing, and I appreciate your engagement with this, because this is what I want us to understand, because frequently our constituents come to us and they say, I'm a mental health provider and I can't make enough to provide service to these people on Medicaid, or a dentist, or another kind of medical provider, right, or a hospital. And then we try to investigate it and then come to find out that we really can't do anything about it because they're on managed care, TMAP as I call it, and we don't have control of it. So I'd like Ms. Marquardt to just comment on that. And on your slide here it says, and I did not know this, that federal managed care regulations prohibit states from requiring specific payment rates to providers, except under specific limited conditions. So this is what we're talking about. So Ms. Marquardt, do you want to comment on this?
Certainly, Madam Chair, that's correct. So those what were the pass-through payments that we just talked about are prohibited entirely, where you're just passing money and drawing down FFP or federal financial participation, which is our federal share. Those are prohibited entirely. You can do some directed payments where we can say, through our contracts, managed care organizations must pay at least this or exactly this, but it also then has to be tied to an outcome measure that is meant to either improve access, improve the health and well-being of people, that there is some sort of outcome attached to that as to why we would do that, because it generally violates the principle of managed care where you provide the flexibility to the MCO, where a state may think that's important to do around an initiative that might be improving the quality of care, the access to care. We do have some allowance to do those things, and we do have some examples. Our integrated health partnerships payments are one of those examples where that's a value-based care arrangement, and those are allowed under federal law. I will say, though, to the point of what's our visibility into these costs, the plans all do quarterly financial reporting. We do get encounter claims, which is basically a copy of the claims that they pay to providers. All of that generally is public information. The exception to that is the actual price that they paid to any individual provider is protected as non-public. So we can share any, they do report their medical loss ratios, which gets to the how much are they paying for services versus how much they received in revenue. So are they losing or gaining money? And then there is, as of this most recent federal regulation, a requirement that they cannot have a medical loss ratio that is lower than 85%. Otherwise, they have to provide funds back to the state, because that means they were spending far less on medical services than was intended in the rates.
So I'm going to go on, Representative Munson, some great questions. We have three more members on the list. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think two things for clarity. First of all, to follow up on the medical loss ratio, how can members find that information?
Ms. Marquardt? Madam Chair, we can provide that to you for whatever years you're interested in, and we have through completed 2017.
That might be interesting to see, Madam Chair. And then, Madam Chair, I think that when I think about the medical loss ratio, I think about what percentage of our dollars are being spent on actual health care as opposed to administration and other things. And so 85% would, you know, be, you know, 85 cents on the dollars the way I look at it. So you can confirm if that's correct. But the other thing that I wanted to get to is actually goes back to Representative Moran's questions about the hospitals. You mentioned that they have to they get paid for what their costs are. And I'm wondering how we determine what those costs are in MA, because cost is always, underlying cost is always a big question when we're talking about care. And I'm curious how we can find that information and learn more about the calculations that you do to determine costs, because that's always, to me, a big mystery.
Ms. Marquardt. Madam Chair, with respect to you're correct about the 85 cents on the dollar. I can confirm that that's a very, yes, it's 85% of the cost went to services for people. With respect to hospital costs, I will say that, and certainly the Hospital Association can speak to this far more clearly than I can, but hospitals are one of the places where we have some of the most transparency into what it actually costs. Hospitals do a very detailed Medicare cost report, and then we have them provide additional detail with respect to their Medicaid costs so that we can actually cost every claim that they have provided to us in fee-for-service. We have started to try to do some of that work with our managed care and counterclaims. We do that for rate setting so that when we know, for instance, that we want to know what percentage of cost are we providing, does our payment cover for any given line of service, any given hospital, any given region, so that we can really determine are we providing sufficient access, are we covering cost effectively. We did a lot of work about in 2014 with the hospitals and the Hospital Association to basically revamp how we did hospital rates to make it more transparent to people and the hospitals. And one of the big things we did was correct a really unfair system to critical access hospitals, where we had anywhere from cost coverage of 20% on some claims to others where we were paying well over 100% of cost. And so to fix that and create stability for those hospitals, which we desperately need to remain viable in those communities, they count on them. So we have really tried to partner to create stability across the hospital systems throughout the state. So that is a place we actually do have quite a bit of transparency.
Okay, thank you. And so I've got Representative Mann, Representative Loeffler, Representative Munson, and we have still a little more left of the presentation. I think what we're going to do is try to get through these questions quickly. As members can tell, we could be talking just about rate setting and this little part of it for a long time, and we probably should, but we can't do it today. We have folks that have come from Greater Minnesota to testify. So for about five more minutes, we'll stay with this, and I'm sorry that we may not really get into the IHP part of it. Maybe just to tell us, like, what it is. But I'm going to go to Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when we pay the managed care organization a fee per patient, do we require them to cover certain services, or is that part of the negotiation that they have between the providers?
Ms. Marquardt? Madam Chair, they are required to cover all of the Medicaid-covered services that are in our state law. So they cannot choose not to cover certain services that are required under, and that's part of our agreement with the federal government, that all enrollees have access to all services.
Follow-up, Representative.
And so we're paying just the managed care $5 billion per year, correct?
I'm sure that, yes, it's actually over $5 billion, but yes.
And can we account for all that money? Do we know where all of it's going?
Ms. Marquardt. Small question.
Madam Chair, I think we have done, so again, a lot of work has been done in working with the legislature on better reporting, making sure that we're only including costs that are allowable. We did a big initiative with the legislature around 2014 to identify administrative costs that should not be. So it is a, I can't say to the penny that I can account for every penny. That would be false for me to say that. We do tie out financial reporting to their encounter claims to make sure that when we're setting rates that we're only including costs for covered services and that they do reflect. And we have been strengthening the amount we're relying on those actual claims paid to providers. And then we also, the legislative auditor does audits of the managed care organizations, and DHS does audits of the managed care organizations to audit those encounter claims and those administrative costs to ensure that we are only including costs that truly happened and that the services really were rendered and that was an appropriate payment that was made.
Okay. So as you can see, there's a lot more to learn about this as well. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Marquardt. We can't get the payment to an individual provider, but what can we do to increase the transparency to really understand what we're paying for particular services? Because we routinely get complaints from our most basic provider levels. I don't hear much from the specialists. Maybe the HMOs reward them well, and it's the primary care, mental health, you know, dentists that aren't getting a fair shake. I'm not sure. We don't know if they are or not because we don't have data. What would prohibit you from using your encounter data to give us geographically, and so it wouldn't identify an individual provider, what is paid for a well child checkup? What is paid for a prenatal visit? What is paid for a basic mental health assessment? What is paid for a basic CD counseling session? Could you, under the laws that you're constrained by, use our encounter data so that just like with the hospitals, we can see if it's a fair reimbursement, if some are getting 20% of costs and some are getting 100%.
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, so we certainly can provide aggregated data in that way. And Heather here is actually the director of the Health Research and Quality Division where that type of information could be pulled. So I'm committing her to, if there's something you want to know, we absolutely can provide it. I will say this, though, outside of hospitals, getting a provider's actual cost is really, it has proven to be a mighty challenge. Outside of hospitals, there is not a very uniform way. The other exception I would say is federally qualified health centers. They also do Medicare cost reporting, so they are one other place. We set encounter rates for them. That's a separate, whole separate rate structure for them. Outside of those two providers, we have really had a hard time nailing down what actual cost is, because the rest of the providers outside of those that are tied to a hospital system just don't look at things that way, and they don't look at costs uniformly. So what one calls one thing, somebody calls another. And so we have really struggled to do cost. We could give you what the payments are. That we have, but we do not have the backdrop, even in fee-for-service, of costs for most providers.
All right. Well, thank you. We're going to kind of have
Thank you. I will follow up with Heather on this, but I do think that might be something very useful.
I think so, too. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I've got Representative Munson, if you can do it real short, because Representative Schultz hasn't had an opportunity yet. Please. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last year, I carried through price transparency legislation that requires providers to post their cash price, average of private insurance, and then the Medicare and Medicaid or the medical assistance payments for the top, like, 35 most frequently billed and preventative care services. That is, the Governor Dayton signed that single subject bill into law. It goes into effect July 1st. And so, in July 1st, we'll be able to see the medical assistance reimbursement rates for, you know, many services at these clinics. Is that data that would help us determine the amount of money that's being going back and forth between insurance companies or the managed care organizations and each of the providers so that we can compare and contrast between providers within a specific region to understand those rates and how they're negotiated?
Ms. Marquardt?
Madam Chair, I do think, while again it doesn't get us to how much does our rate actually cover costs, nor what any commercial payer, the one piece of information that we don't have is, to your point, we don't know where our rate compares to what they've contracted on the commercial side. So that will improve the transparency across all lines of business to be able to say, you know, we're facility X and this is what we're paid for this from this payer, this payer, this payer, this payer. That is not data that we would have. So that is that would be a new lens on at least price information.
Okay. Representative Schultz.
Minor, quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. So there's new federal rulemaking going on that affects things in the ACA market. And I've read that they're going to reduce the medical loss ratio to 70%. And I believe we have in state law that our medical loss ratio has to be 85%. So will that put at risk any federal funding through the Medicaid program if we have a different requirement for the medical loss ratio?
Ms. Marquardt, if you know.
Madam Chair, generally speaking, and rulemaking, they can come out with whatever they want, but generally speaking, the current 85% is a minimum. States can require higher than that. So if that principle holds, even if they lower it, the state could choose to have a higher MLR requirement.
Great. One more question.
Representative Schultz.
So the other question, given that there's these new prohibitions you've outlined that came down in 2016, are we prohibited from directly contracting with providers and paying them directly in our MA program?
Marquardt?
Madam Chair, we are prohibited if we are also paying a fully capitated rate to a managed care organization, unless we carve the service out where the capitation would not include costs for that service, then the state can make the payment directly. Otherwise, if it's part of the capitated rate, we couldn't come in and simply make the payment. So there are mechanisms and tools we have to do that in some cases, and we have used those in some areas.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. So, sorry, we are behind. We do have this section on IHPs, and Ms. Peterman, right? Peterman. Sorry, we've kind of gone through your thing here. Do you have, like, 2 minutes? You can just kind of tell us what IHPs are, and then, you know, we'll probably bring you back another day to talk more.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. So maybe just to succinctly say what an IHP is.
And please pull the mic a little closer. Thanks.
Thank you. The IHP program is layers across the fee-for-service and managed care payment structures that Julie mentioned. And DHS has a contract with an integrated delivery system or a provider collaborative where we can allow them to share in the savings that they help generate or the losses that get created if they don't meet a total cost of care target. And the idea is that by having that incentive for them to look at a patient's costs holistically, then moving the dollars that are associated with that care closer to the patient-provider relationship, it allows the provider to share in the savings that are created by reducing unnecessary costs and improving care coordination.
Okay. Well, thank you for that really brief explanation. We will have to do more on this because I think it will be important for members to understand. So thank you all very much for presenting today. And I'm going to call up our folks that are here to tell us a little bit about county-based purchasing. And just so members understand, we just heard about the managed care organizations, and some of our managed care organizations are a different type that are called county-based purchasers, and that is what we're going to hear about next, kind of what they are and how they fit into this whole picture. So, you know, we have layers of complication upon layers of complication, and I don't know if other states have it so complicated like we do, but to the degree possible, I want you to at least understand the big components of how we are doing healthcare in our public programs. Welcome to the committee. please introduce yourself and go ahead with your presentation.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Jim Prezzavilla. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Prime West Health, a county-based purchasing organization serving 13 rural Minnesota counties and headquartered in Alexandria.
And Mr. Prezzavilla, again, please pull the mic close to you.
Sorry, I have my radio voice on. It's kind of down.
It's great, but I don't know if people can hear so clearly if you're not close to the mic.
I'm trying to here. Okay. We'll have to move a little bit. But.
Brad Anderson, Goodyear County Commissioner, also chair of the South Country Board in Owatonna, serving 12 members.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Leota Lind. I'm the CEO of South Country Health Alliance. As Commissioner Anderson stated, we serve 11 member counties, or are a joint powers of 11 member counties in rural Minnesota.
Okay, well, thanks for being here today. Please go ahead.
For audiovisual works here today, we have a presentation, kind of a no-talking presentation for the first couple of minutes that kind of gives you the context of what we're talking about. The theme is all healthcare is local, and I think it gives you an understanding. If you understand this, you really understand the premise and why county-based purchasing was developed in Minnesota back in the 90s. We'll see if it works. If not, we'll wing it.
All right.
And I don't think our sound is working. And I don't hum very well, so I can't give you the musical background to this. So, so we will probably bypass that. Pardon me? The theme of what we wanted to show you was that all healthcare is local. And there's a variety of meanings to that, but it also describes the connectivity between rural, suburban Minnesota, and urban Minnesota. That what we do in each part of our state really affects the greater part of the state. And when we speak of greater Minnesota, it's often in the phrase of rural Minnesota, but we happen to think that working together, we make the entire state a greater state to live in. And it really put context to that. It was based on a prose that was written many years ago about how healthcare is local and about how we're getting more global, and global is becoming local, and local is becoming global. And the interconnectivity and sometimes the segments we create in our decision-making between rural and urban and suburbia affect the greater good. County-based purchasing is very much a locally-based model. And we'll proceed to the main part of the PowerPoint, which is more of the talking head. We had hoped to spare you after talking heads for the last 45 minutes, but we'll just go right into it. And you, I believe, all have slideshow slides in your.
Yeah, members do have the slide packet.
It was really nice to have DHS present before, and I thought Julie and PJ and Heather did a very nice job with that because it really saves us to explain a lot of context in which county-based purchasing was created. We kind of subdivide a little bit of what Julie talked about. She had broken it out in terms of the traditional fee-for-service and managed care and also IHP. We actually distinguish between traditional managed care, which we believe is more when the original program was set out, it was meant to be contracts between the state of Minnesota and private HMOs that you're familiar with. County-based purchasing is within the managed care because we do take the risk-based contracts, same terms as the HMOs, but this is different. It's actually administered by the community that we serve. And then, of course, Heather briefly talked about IHPs, and there's an emerging part of the IHP that will, I think Heather said or PJ said that would be in 2020 that they'll be looking for. So just wanted to distinguish about that in the fact that county-based purchasing was a kind of a later arrival on the scene. Going back to the mid-80s is when PMAP, as Prepaid Medical Assistance Program, as it was called then, but also still called in statute, was developed and piloted in, I believe, three different counties. There was one urban, one suburban, and one rural. Based on that, in the mid-90s, the state decided to roll it out statewide. There was concerns about the results of the pilot project with the HMOs that were contracted by rural counties in particular, and they found some things that concerned them. And one of those were that local providers could be excluded from the healthcare networks of those HMOs, that the use of the prior authorization process sometimes put the cost on the county, which made it thought that the same service was being paid for twice, once by the state taxpayer, because that service was intended to be covered by the state program, but if not covered, it fell on the county. And the county is often the payer of last resort in healthcare. And this was particularly in the area of behavioral health or mental health and substance abuse treatment. So in the mid-90s, this is really a community-based development. It was the legislature working with counties to develop another model for delivering the managed care portion of the prepaid medical assistance program. And in 1997, it was actually passed into law. One of the counties that was actually the pilot is actually now considered a county-based purchasing plan, and that was IM Care, Itasca Medical Care, headquartered in Grand Rapids, one of the county-based purchasing organizations. But it really didn't have that name until after the law was passed in 1997. To distinguish ourselves just a little bit, just to give you contrast, is that to understand county-based purchasing, we do the very same things that's expected of the managed care organizations, but the structure is different. We're locally owned and governed by the counties we serve. It's, in essence, the state is not contracting with a corporation. It's contracting with the community, and the community is taking the responsibility and the risk to deliver Minnesota healthcare programs to their most vulnerable residents. That, in essence, is it with county-based purchasing. There's exceptions because, as I think Julie indicated, Hennepin Health is actually known as a county-owned HMO. And they're very much in a very similar structure as it is owned by Hennepin County and operates in very much those two areas that I have in the asterisks on that chart. One of the things that we think is a real advantage of being county is that you'll hear this more, newer committee members, and I know the older committee members, meaning older being on the committee longer. You're very welcome. Social determinants of health. That's something that has been around forever but has a label now. Those are those things that we've known that beyond medical, these are the things that determine our health and well-being that really aren't defined on medical terms. Housing, access to heating, access to transportation, the environment I live in. New emerging ones, ACEs, those things that happen early on in your childhood that affects your health and behavior later on in life. These things are very much, and in the most part, are the things that drive our mortality and morbidity. It just so happens the counties, particularly in rural Minnesota, is where most of the resources are that are there to address the social determinants of health, whether they be housing, heating assistance, transportation. In our counties, most of the mental health providers are actually county. And that puts us in a role of having the Minnesota Healthcare Benefit Payment Structure integrated with those resources, which gives us the ability then to bring those resources to the medical community and work hand-in-hand together to really improve the health and well-being and the cost of healthcare in our areas. One thing that our group, and we're known collectively as the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans, the three of us, one of the things that we believe in is that all the models that Minnesota have are worthwhile. And indeed, it's good to have choice. It's just that there's not one model that fits all communities well and all counties. And all of our models can be improved upon. Since Prime West has been going operational in 2001, we've probably had three or four different transformations on how we do this because healthcare is a changing environment. And costs are going higher. New technologies, new therapies, new types of providers are being introduced almost weekly, it seems like. So we have to keep current. We have to stay dynamic. And each model can be responsive in different ways. So it's good for counties in the state to have choice to what's the best fit to the unique dynamics and characteristics of each county in the state of Minnesota. And as they say, when you've seen one Minnesota county, you've seen one Minnesota county. They're all very unique. And it doesn't matter if you're rural or urban, you may have those things, but you can go around suburban, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and those counties are different, very much different, just like in rural Minnesota. They could share a border, but they're very much different as you cross that county line sometimes.
And but we also, Mr. Prisbilla, sorry to interrupt, but I just want to let you know that we just have 15 minutes left for the committee, and we want to hear from everybody, too. Thank you.
And the state and counties jointly and equally decide, we believe, what model will work best. And we really emphasize jointly and equally. We think it's both a matter of state policy, but state policy has to be delivered at the local level, and we believe the county needs to have input on that.
Madam Chair. Jim will be doing the majority of the presentation, but I think really that's one of the beauties regarding county-based purchasing as well, is that all three of us are county-based purchasing plans, Itasca Medical Care, South Country, and Prime West, and we share a very similar philosophy and mission as to how we go about the process. But yet we all function a little bit differently and have a little bit of a different model. And that's by design, because we really are working to define that model based on the needs of the individual counties that we're serving. So I think it's one of the great flexibilities of county-based purchasing.
Thank you. Mr. Priscilla.
Oh, you bet. Madam Chair, we do have kind of a rotation ready to go here. So
okay. It's
not like we're going to do staged ones. We're just going to work in and out of our presentation here.
Whatever. I just want to make sure you understood the time.
Appreciate it. Okay. Yeah, we don't have a clock looking at us, so it makes it a little difficult here. So one of the things, and this is where Brad's going to talk about, is county-based purchasing, as Julie described from DHS, that when we take on the contract with DHS, we're at risk. We're going to only get so much money on a per-member, per-month basis to cover the total cost of care, as well as conduct our operations. So there's a risk involved. And if the rates are inadequate or our costs exceed, that's on us. It actually falls, in our case, if we don't have adequate reserves, it will fall on the county to be basically the guarantee that these bills will be paid. But as in the case that there are 25 rural counties that have chosen to take in that risk, there shows that there's a lot of things that go beyond just the money, and maybe Commissioner.
I think that's where I jump in and talk about the integration. That's what us as county commissioners are interested in. It's integrating the health care that we're delivering with this plan into our Health and Human Service Department, our Public Health Department, to help attain those goals that the Department of Health wants us to attain, the Department of Human Service wants us to attain, and our citizens are looking for. And so by integrating those programs together and having a say in a little bit of what we can do with the health plan, also integrating with all of those, and then from a local standpoint, as Jim was talking about, we know what our local providers are. We know who they are. We know who can provide the transportation, who can provide the health, mental health, who can do all those things, and we can integrate that and treat that person holistically as far as health and outcomes, instead of just working on someone working on the health part of it and us working on all those other things to try to underpin that person.
So let me ask a question about that. There was a lot of interest in when we talked about PMAP generally about rates and how rates are set. Can you describe how do county-based purchasing organizations handle the rate setting with providers? And are all the providers in your area in your network, or do you pick some and not others? Ms. Lind.
Madam Chair. So rates are contracted or negotiated individually with our providers. So depending on the provider type, that rate is structured there. We do, we do negotiate those rates on an annual basis. And I'm sorry, I forgot the second part of your question, Madam Chair.
I forgot the second part of it, too.
All
providers. Thank you.
So I think that's been one of the hallmarks for our organization, is that one of the things that we've really looked at, and going back to those concerns that were expressed in the early days of managed care, was that concern about rural providers not being included in a broader network. We recognize the importance of maintaining that provider infrastructure within our communities, and that's extremely important to us. We want to do everything that we can to support and maintain the providers that we currently have within our communities, and also do what we can to help attract new providers to our community. So we really do accept and offer contracts to any provider within our service area that can meet the qualifications and requirements. We routinely work with our county public health and human service directors, that they may contact us and say, there's a new dental provider in our community. Here's their information, and we immediately outreach them to attempt to get them into our network.
So that is a critical component of it.
And then are people who live in the county able to find out what you pay a dentist or a mental health provider, or is that secret information?
Specific provider rates generally are not public information. We have, as a public organization, we've been pretty transparent in that all of our providers are paid at least the Medicaid or slightly above the Medicaid rate.
Representative Grunhagen.
That was the same question I had.
Okay. Yeah, please continue.
I can speak to the Prime West counties, too. Prime West has always had a policy of contracting with any willing and qualified provider. So access is a key point, and Prime West has used a lot of additional resources to build new providers in our community, actually, to meet the access need. And we do pay above the DHS rate. That's well known. I can be very candid that on average we probably pay about 7% above. That's for across the board. Dental's probably closer to 40%. But we do have unique providers that really, because of their unique and the service that they provide, might make slightly more. I'm not speaking out of turn there as a general statement, but we believe those are things that we are transparent. It's becoming increasingly harder to maintain those rates, but we believe those are something we try to practice payment equity. That, you know, you're always going to be slightly paid. Hospitals obviously going to be paid different than a clinic for professional services. But within that, we want to have a parity in terms of relativity to the DHS methodology and the DHS rate. And for our Medicare, it's very similar, too. We follow the Medicare methodology and do want to pay above that. We understand that both Medicare and Medicare in general pays better than Medicaid. Medicaid can be anywhere from equal to Medicare, perhaps in the case of a critical access hospital, which is paid on a cost basis, all the way down to 30% less or more than the Medicare rate. So Medicaid, people aren't lining up to get Medicaid reimbursement, in other words. So it really is working with them to understand, work with their budgets so they can maintain their access to all Minnesotans.
And then when you say DHS rate,
is the fee-for-service rate. It's kind of the standard expressed as 100% of DHS, and then you pay X percent above. Prime West does not pay below the DHS rate.
Okay. It was just the term I was asking about, because it's kind of, you introduced a term that I think is a little new to us. So you're talking about the rate, as Ms. Marquardt was explaining, the 25% that are paid fee-for-service directly from DHS, and we often call that the fee-for-service rate, and you're just talking about it as the DHS rate.
And they have methodologies that come up with the pricing and so forth, and we mirror those because the providers are familiar with that. And so you can give them a sense of relevance of the rate that they're receiving.
Right. Okay.
Just to add to that a little bit, Madam Chair.
Mr. Anderson.
Someone was talking earlier about rates to providers and providers not being able to sustain them their business under those rates, and I think that's where the local input from county commissioners, from the local staff, helped setting that stage for those to stay in business so that we can have that access in the rural community, because it is harder to maintain those offices in that rural setting.
Representative Grunhagen, question?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just to... it seems like other counties, you've been expanding county-based purchasing system in the state, according to the information actually on the next slide. And then are other states using this model also that we have here? So the first part of the question is, are you expanding with other counties? Yes. Second part is, are other states using a similar model?
Mr. Pisbilla?
Yeah, 11 counties approached Prime West to join Prime West. After the last, they're not satisfied with the current arrangements they have under Minnesota Healthcare Programs Managed Care, and really we're watching, as you notice, they're very close proximity to the Prime West counties, and they talk. And they saw some of the things we were doing, some of the new projects we had started, how we work with providers, and they approached us earlier this year to see if there was an opportunity to join. Individual counties had to make a decision whether to join Prime West or not. And they had to meet certain criteria. Really, we want to know if we had a shared set of values with them and what we're trying to achieve. And those 11 definitely demonstrated that. We will, in the next procurement that Julie Marquardt discussed, we will be including in those in our selection. And we're just in the final stages of approval of our expansion to those counties by the Minnesota Department of Health.
Representative Grunhagen.
Just are other states looking at this model or using this model?
So, Madam Chair, Representative, South Country has done a lot of exploration. There is a model out in California called County Organized Health Systems. And so California uses a managed care environment for the delivery of their public programs. They actually have three models. They have a model that it is a the county is the administers the program within the county to all of their Medicaid eligible individuals. There is another model where it is a competitive process between HMO type programs. And then another model that is one county organized and then a public program. So it's three very distinct models, but the county is really kind of the driver of how they want to deliver the services within their area.
Great. Thank you very much. So I just want to make sure that, you know, again, I want to make sure members have just context for what we're talking about. And I know we're some of us who've been here for a while have the context and others don't. But so this is just one within what I'm calling PMAP, prepaid medical assistance, that Ms. Marquardt was talking about. 75% of our public program health care approximately, they contract with different organizations, and these are some of the organizations that DHS is contracting with. So just to give you that context, and so this is because this is run by the counties, it's actually run by elected officials, right? That's why we have Mr. Anderson here, who's a county commissioner, elected official, right, in your county. And Mr. Anderson, could you just give us, and I do have one other member question, but if you could just give us kind of briefly, from the point of view of a county commissioner, what is your role in all of this?
Well, I mean, as a county commissioner, we sit with somebody from our board, from our county board, sits on, from each county, sits that actually operates these organizations. From Prime West, they have one from each of their counties. In South Country, it's one from each of the counties. So on a monthly basis, sometimes on a biweekly basis, we're meeting and we're actually making the decisions and actually overseeing this whole process of delivering this managed care to our citizens in our communities.
Right.
Yeah. Beyond that, our county human service directors and our county public health directors, there's also a seat at the table for them in helping direct how we implement these plans and integrate these plans within our counties. And I think that's a key part of it. Is we're taking the staff that are on the ground delivering this and actually making them be part of the process on how we deliver it. And then the oversight and the transparency, of course, being elected officials, we're really kind of an extension of the state in delivering this program. We're co-branches of government delivering the program to the local counties.
And so, Commissioner, if your local constituents don't like the way you're spending the money or don't like the service they're getting,
they
know where to find you, right?
Don't tell them, yes.
Right, right.
They know where to find me in the grocery store. They know where to find me at the hardware store. They know how to find me, trust me.
Right.
And even Representative Haley knows how to find me.
Well, right, and she's next on the list, so she thinks she found you. Go ahead, Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I don't have a question. I just was a comment. I wanted to reiterate what the Commissioner and Ms. Lind already said. The uniqueness of this is that integration and the fact that I think constituents who are using these services feel very vested because they know me, they know the Commissioner, and they know we sit at the same table. We have an annual meeting or even twice a year where this program is on the agenda. So that's just a very different connection than with other services. So the integration is key, and the investment that community members have is also different. And I also would say in southern Minnesota, it's good to have some competition in this whole arena. And so I am a proponent of the county-based purchasing, and I have never had a constituent be, call me and be dissatisfied with it. Mm-hmm. So it has worked very well.
Thank you very much. And Representative Loeffler, and then we'll finish up here.
I was just going to make a comment that you've got two slides that show what the state gets from CBH, county-based purchasing, and I think you forgot one that I know because my constituents don't always get it, and that is continuity of care, which we know really improves healthcare outcomes. If you can develop a relationship, you can track that person and trust them with your health situation, you're more likely to reach out. And in my area where we've had 4 to 5 health plans, some dropped, some added, we've had hundreds of thousands of people with very short notice having to totally change who they're going to see for some of the most personal care that they need.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. So, Mr. Prisbilla, Ms. Lind, and Commissioner Anderson, thank you very much for making your way up here in the cold weather. We really appreciate it. And, members, we are adjourned.